Ever notice how the most important conversations are the ones we never have? Three realtors walked through a dead woman's house, each seeing something different in the crown molding and hardwood floors. One saw flaws, another saw care, the third saw dollar signs and desire. But none of them saw what really mattered, that this wasn't just a house in a coveted Catholic school district. It was the last physical proof that someone had once believed the home was the foundation of true happiness in America. And now it had to be sold, quickly, before anyone could admit what was really being lost. We spend our lives building containers for our identities, homes, careers, relationships, then wonder why we feel trapped inside them. The discomfort isn't in the structures themselves, but in the gap between who we are and who we've convinced ourselves we should be. Webster Groves was just right. Tree-lined streets, Victorian homes, Wednesday church suppers, summer evenings at the municipal pool. This was the America of relatively equitable income distribution, where station wagons and driveways represented modest comfort rather than conspicuous consumption. A mother cultivated perennial gardens with reliable succession of blooms, taught children to bake in the kitchen, created window seats for rainy afternoon reading. She believed able people owed society their talents, a philosophy that shaped civic engagement across generations. But something fundamental shifted. Families dispersed to the coasts seeking opportunity, mirroring how the country fled its economic center. Vast wealth disparities emerged that would have troubled anyone who valued character over achievement. During Hurricane Katrina, living comfortably in Manhattan while watching the government's failures created a particular kind of rage, the guilt of distance, the impotence of charity appeals, the question of what someone who truly believed in civic duty would have done. The house that anchored decades of change became just another property, its memories packed in boxes marked keep and donate, its foundation crumbling under the weight of what it could no longer hold.
May 1970, Kent State still fresh. A father and son fought, not about Vietnam, which they both opposed, but about a summer job at Sverdrup & Parcel, a major engineering firm. The son had deliberately chosen distant Rice University to study film instead of architecture, wore bell-bottoms and lefty sensibilities completely at odds with the conservative, military-influenced culture awaiting him. Their argument escalated. The son burst into the shared bedroom, sarcastically shouting, "You'll get over it," while packing. The mother followed, sobbing. Next morning, everything felt dreamlike and unmentionable. When questioned about the older brother attending the younger's class play, the mother broke down. They'd had a terrible fight, he'd left, whereabouts unknown. This wasn't one family's fracture, it was nationwide. Depression and World War II survivors couldn't understand why children would reject security. Young people saw their parents' lives as conformist traps. The older brother eventually returned, but something fundamental had changed, an acknowledgement that the world was moving faster than anyone could control. Some fathers never tell jokes or play silly games. They throw balls awkwardly as things they wanted to get rid of. Born to harsh 19th-century Scandinavian parents, losing a charismatic older brother to drowning, watching parents and niece die in separate car accidents, socially invisible in high school, shocking everyone by becoming valedictorian. At university registration, a father dictated the career path. He's going to be a civil engineer. 50 years of restless compliance followed. After death, only one personal keepsake from childhood remained. Valentines from classmates, but nothing from parents.
Guilt consumed everything. A classmate's death, a killed frog, neglected washcloths, preferring certain marbles. Even stuffed animals required strict rotation, except realistic Mr. Bear, whose otherness resisted anthropomorphizing. In Miss Niblack's homonym spelldown, Chris Tochko trembled through liar and was rejected. Victory came with lie, rier, liar, it's a stringed instrument. But Tochko was melting down, unnoticed. The principal's unabridged dictionary revealed liar existed, one that lies, as in ambush. Co-winners declared. Months later, Tochko ran into traffic and died. The guilt never left.
Charles Schulz's Peanuts reached 150 million readers because he chose creativity over comfort for 50 years. His true alter ego wasn't failure-prone Charlie Brown, but Protean Snoopy, a character who reimagined himself at will. Simple cartoon faces resonate because they lack the otherly particulars, reminding us of separateness. After social death in junior high, salvation came through the fellowship clique. The flagpole adventure evolved into UNC, sending ransom notes demanding recognition. One night, they disabled school bells by collecting 25 clappers, hiding them with Easter candy, and planting poetic clues throughout the building. Next morning, the bell's beautiful absence felt like the poetry I wanted to learn to write. These nighttime adventures weren't rebellion, they were creative expressions against constraint. Sunday fellowship at First Congregational Church featured blindfolded trust walks, emotional skits, Cat Stevens songs, and friendship haikus. The tight-knit group had grown up together, forming cousin-like bonds. Then ninth grade brought cooler newcomers, guys with beards, a blonde practicing Neil Young songs. The October retreat became a turning point when three members were caught smoking marijuana. The group confronted them in an intense session, everyone addressing the offenders while parents waited outside. The offenders alternated between apologies and challenging everyone about forgiveness. They received a second chance with instructions to tell their parents, though the delayed confession barely registered with parents who just returned from Europe looking cosmopolitan and unconcerned. The group's hidden theoretician argued Christianity needed to reclaim Jesus' radicalism through honesty, confrontation, and struggle. This created space where teenagers could be authentic and grow through difficult conversations. The town's fundamental value, apolitical niceness, made this possible. The church, though largely Republican, consistently chose liberal pastors, including a socialist who wore a beret in the 1930s and a WW2 veteran who preached pacifism throughout the war. This unique environment let teenagers explore identity beyond typical suburban conformity. High school German proved easy but uncool. Parents consulted the medical student brother. He recommended German. At Swarthmore, the flamboyant professor felt resistible, but the drill instructor with Nordic looks and patient manner was adored. In Munich, during junior year abroad, immersion in Goethe's poetry brought the first genuine emotional connection to language, the numinous interplay of verbs like streben, schweben, weben. Reciting Faust on hilltops, recognizing personal emotions in its lines. Back at college, a Greek-American professor whose yellowed, annotation-filled paperbacks testified to his love for literature approached texts with missionary zeal. Discussing Kafka's The Trial, he challenged, "Kafka's about your life. He had problems with sex, women, jobs, parents. He was writing fiction to make sense of life's mess." When he suggested Joseph K. might actually be guilty, outrage followed. But rereading revealed the truth. It had never been truly read at all. Kay wasn't an innocent victim, but a creepy, arrogant, selfish, abusive schmuck refusing to examine his own life. Literature wasn't separate from life, but a tool for making sense of it. The question became, what else had been misread? Returning home for Christmas during college, parents suddenly looked aged. The Webster Groves house looked tired. A father questioned literary efforts. Where is the story? This is all ideas. While a mother was physically and emotionally wrecked from knee operations and ulcerative colitis. She obsessively fretted about upcoming retirement, insisting it was wrong for able, vital people who can still contribute to society. For the first time, seeing family as actual people rather than mere relations, a perspective gained through immersion in literature. That night, after dreams about rejection, came a nightmare. A sweet German shepherd verbally attacking as a frivolous, cynical, attention-seeking fag before literally attacking the throat. Waking to write, "So eines Morgens wurde er verhaftet," the opening line of Kafka's The Trial. One morning, he was arrested. The mother's emotional state deteriorated as she obsessed over feeling deceived by a brother's cohabitation with his girlfriend. During Christmas dinner, she repeatedly apologized for not making traditional cranberry sorbet. Patterns that shaped the family for generations were becoming visible, patterns that would need understanding before breaking free. The last day with a mother, she repeatedly asked if the Californian was the woman who would be the one, if they'd marry, if she wanted children, hoping for a glimpse of how life would continue after she was gone. She'd always loved being part of things, and having strong opinions was her way of not feeling left out. After my mother died in summer 1999, I went birdwatching for the first time on Hat Island near Everett, Washington. I spotted eagles, kingfishers, Bonaparte's gulls, goldfinches, and my first northern flicker, its careening beauty reminiscent of a former girlfriend I still fondly remembered. By then, I'd met a vegetarian Californian writer, a fool for animals, with no interest in pregnancy, marriage, or moving to New York. Returning to New York after South Texas left me hollow, like an addict in withdrawal. Each night, I studied bird books and dreamed vividly of birds. Two kestrels appeared outside my kitchen window, bloodying their beaks on fresh-killed mice, their dislocation mirroring my own. At a lecture, Al Gore's surprisingly humorous but deeply disturbing presentation on global warming filled me with teenage-like dread. I rationalized my concerns away. Energy-efficient Manhattan apartment, no car, 10th-floor location safe from flooding. Most importantly, not having kids freed me from caring about future generations. Yet the worrying wouldn't stop. Billions of birds facing extinction from climate change. Some of us don't get to choose what we love. We only get to choose whether we'll admit it, whether we'll let that love change how we live, or whether we'll rationalize it away until we can't recognize ourselves anymore.